Welcome back to the program. Politics in America has become a blood sport at worst, and at best, part of our celebrity entertainment culture. What we often forget is that inside this culture are not just celebrities or politicians, but real people with real lives, complex relationships, and complicated and evolving marriages. Marriages that, like the Obamas, where what we see is like the iceberg with only 10% showing to the world. To mix metaphors still further, marriages in general and political marriages in particular are like the proverbial snowflakes. No two are alike. My guest, New York Times correspondent Jody Kantor, in her new book, The Obamas, takes a look inside the Obama family, the Obama marriage, and the complexity of a modern professional marriage inside the crucible of the White House. All the more nuanced given our national obsession with race and class. Jody Kantor attended Harvard Law School. She joined Slate in 1998 and 4 years later became the arts and leisure editor of the New York Times. She's been covering the Obamas since 2007, writing numerous front page stories for the New York Times. And it is my pleasure to welcome Jody Kantor here to talk about the Obamas. Jody Kantor, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you here. In many ways, this story is very Bergman-esque. I mean, it could be seen as
that is a word I haven't used. I haven't heard used to describe it yet. Tell me what you mean.
And it's seen from a marriage in a political context, which is something we don't always get to see.
Yes. We do and we don't. I think that there's a long history of looking at presidential partnerships because they're so important to the presidency. So I was very inspired by some of the great books that I read about Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt and the Kennedys and about Bill and Hillary Clinton, because we really see in every one of these cases that the kind of dynamic and back and forth between the president and first lady ends up being really important to the country. But there was another dimension with the Obama story too, which is that I've been covering the Obamas for 5 years for the New York Times, and they went through such a remarkable transformation, Jeff. I mean, when I first started covering them, their lives were really a lot like yours or mine. I mean, the president was a senator, of course, but he hadn't lived in the political bubble for a long time, and his wife certainly had not. And especially as I started to report in the White House, I saw the incredible transformation that happens when you become president and first lady, and that, you know, it's not something that happens in a click on election night or on inauguration day, and that it affected every aspect of their lives.
Part of it also is age. The fact that they came to the presidency, as you say, relatively young and without a whole lot of experience living in what Bill Clinton used to call public housing, and that the change really had a profound effect on them. And it's arguably, you know, as you write about it, it made the president more introverted, it made Michelle more public, and it changed the dynamic of the marriage in ways that impacted both politics and policy.
I think that's absolutely right. Yes, the Obamas were new to Washington in so many ways. They, as you say, they were pretty young generationally. The president did not have a lot of managerial or economic or national security experience. The first lady had never been like a traditional political wife sitting there, you know,
right,
in the front row clapping. She had been a professional woman. They had never spent a lot of time in Washington. The president was still getting lost in the halls of Congress when he ran. And on top of that, they're the first African-American president and first lady. And so they get to the White House and they have to learn to work out these new roles. That, you know, the book just tells story after story, anecdote after anecdote of behind-the-scenes stuff, of really watching them through trial and error figure out these jobs. And we also see them adapting their partnership to the White House. And, you know, their partnership has become a very important political tool. In 2012, we are going to see a lot of images of the Obamas together.
Right. And part of it is the irony in the process that we elect leaders, certainly we elect presidents, because of a sense of authenticity. And then once we elect them, we never want to allow them to be authentic.
You know, that to me is one of the great questions I was trying to answer. People, especially people in Chicago when I started my reporting, said they wanted to know what happened to Barack and Michelle. What happened to the two people we kind of used to know? We see them as president and first lady, and they're so guarded and so scripted, and We have no sense of, you know, what they make of this experience and what their real reactions are. So there are a lot of stories in the book that, you know, that reveal some of the painful parts of the adjustment, the, you know, the scrutiny, the behind-the-scenes pressure. I wanted readers to go through this book and say, wow, I never knew that a president or first lady faced such and such, you know, a challenge or a rule or a day-to-day situation. How would I handle that if I was in that situation?
The other overlay to this, and Obama's reticence about politics is a big part of this, because the genius of politics, particularly in the White House, always seems to be the way in which any president and first lady is able to translate their private life into their public life.
I think you're so right about that. And we see that doing, we see them doing them that a little bit more now. You can see them trying to kind of reconnect a bit more in the run-up to 2012. Like the president, I mean, remember when the president sang a few bars of that Al Green song,
right,
at the Apollo Theater? I hate to say it, but that got more attention in popular culture than some of the, you know, things he said about, say, the economy or about national security lately. So, and the, you know, the First Lady went on the Ellen DeGeneres show and did all of those push-ups. So you can really see them trying to reach back out across the chasm, right, and reconnect with Americans on a almost casual level.
The other aspect is the degree to which, as time has gone on, she seems a lot happier in the White House than he is.
Well, that was true this summer. You know, by the time I ended my reporting, I was confronted with a really surprising twist, because to me, over the years, Michelle Obama was always the reluctant one, the one who never really wanted a political life, did it just to, you know, sort of because she didn't want to stop her husband and she really believed in him. By this summer, aides were saying that she had kind of adjusted better to this life than the president had, because remember that the debt ceiling crisis was like the nadir of the Obama presidency. He's come back somewhat since then, but this is a guy who ran in 2004 saying there's no red America, there's no blue America, there's only a United States of America, right? We're unified, we're all going to be on the same page. And it turns out that in the debt ceiling crisis, he can't even get Republicans and Democrats to sit together around a table and kind of work out a common sense compromise. So it was a really tough summer for him. But we see that he's rallied somewhat. And he's clearly, we've all seen the way he's cheered by the kind of disorganization and disarray in the Republican field.
Right. There's also the sense of him not being always comfortable in the political arena. I mean, the most telling story is, of course, the first Super Bowl party at the White House, where he sits there and watches the game. It's hard to imagine Bill Clinton doing that.
Yes, Bill Clinton. I mean, the ultimate contrast is always going to be between Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. They're so different. Barack Obama has discipline of which Bill Clinton can only dream, right? we cannot possibly imagine Barack Obama getting himself into trouble the way Bill Clinton did. On the other hand, Bill Clinton is really the sort of ultimate retail politician. He is the guy who will not stop shaking hands at the end of an event. And Barack Obama has never had that kind of full-throated appetite for politics.
Talk a little bit about the way Michelle Obama has changed and the way she has come to see politics, the political process, and the importance of politics with respect to her ideals and her visions of policy.
Well, the big influence that Michelle Obama has on the presidency is not the kind of caricatured image of the First Lady rushing into the West Wing to quote-unquote meddle with policy affairs. You know, she never went in during the summer of 2009 when they were talking health care and said, it's the public option or bust. It's more the sense that, you know, she has a transformative idea of what her husband can do. She believes that her husband is not an everyday politician, that he was elected to do big things, that he should ignore what people in the White House often call the noise of Washington. And so early in the administration, she really pushed him to take on some ambitious but politically unpopular efforts like health care legislation and immigration reform. And that's why there was some philosophical conflict with people like Rahm Emanuel, who were much more kind of, they're practiced politicos. They're cautious. They don't want the president to do things that could potentially cost, say, congressional seats, let alone re-election.
Right. To what extent is he very aware of her vision of him as this transformative leader and what she would hope that he could accomplish? And what impact does that have on him day to day?
I think he's extremely aware of it. And, my impression from my reporting is that it's a double-edged sword, that mm-hmm. he's absolutely buoyed and encouraged by it, and that he really, that it's an important voice for him to hear. On the other hand, as president, there's no way you can live up to those ideals fully, right? I mean, every president has to make deals that are unattractive. If you want to get things through Congress, you have to make a lot of compromises that can turn your stomach. So I think part of their reckoning was the collision between those dreams of the Obama presidency that Michelle Obama really held on to and the reality of Washington.
And has that had a negative impact in any way on the president? I mean, I think about it in the context historically of presidents that have always been haunted by the expectations of parents, particularly fathers in many cases, and how in some cases that too has been a double-edged sword.
Well, the president, what the president has said about his father, I'm not using his exact words, but what he's basically said is that his dad was a disappointment, right? His dad was a promising guy who really messed up. He messed up his marriages. He became an alcoholic. He grew so sort of bitter and resentment and filled with resentment that his ideas weren't recognized in Kenya, that, he really sort of lost his place in the process. And the president never wanted to become that. And part of what I think is interesting is that it's so clear biographically that he married who he married in part to make sure that he didn't end up like his dad, right? I mean, mm-hmm. he married a very strong, practical, grounded woman who, one thing that I think people don't always get about Michelle Obama is that she's a real square. This is somebody who is in a way a very conservative person, right? Somebody who exercises all the time and goes to sleep at 10 o'clock at night and drills her children really hard on their homework and their schoolwork. This is not a kind of, there are areas where she takes risks in her life, but this is not an out there person. This is a very structured person.
To what extent does she hold him back in some ways, both positively and negatively?
Well, the famous example is, her trying to keep his kind of ego in check. Obama has incredible confidence, and there are lots of examples over the years of her bringing him back to earth. I mean, even when they first got to the White House, this is such a small detail, but I think it's telling. There was mm-hmm. a Stevie Wonder concert, and the president was introducing Stevie Wonder, and they had this whole, podium with a presidential seal set up with it, and Michelle Obama just looked at it and said, "Why does he need to introduce Stevie Wonder from behind the presidential seal? Can't he just be like a normal person who gets up there for 2 minutes with a microphone and introduces Stevie Wonder?" So she really questioned that kind of pomp of the White House, where the president is constantly treated like a king. So I think that's been a helpful thing in the presidency. One thing I really found in my reporting is that people started to treat Barack Obama very strangely when he was first elected. Nobody, even Brad Pitt, there's a great mm-hmm, little story right. about Brad Pitt coming to the Oval Office, and even he grows very silent and very shy. And Michelle Obama is really the one person who treated her husband normally.
Talk a little bit about that confidence and the impact that it has, because There's a story that has been sort of maybe apocryphal in talking about the difference between Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, that when you meet with Barack Obama, he makes you feel he's the smartest person in the room. Bill Clinton makes you feel like you're the smartest person in the room.
Yeah, I think they're, you know, I'll tell you a funny joke that one of my colleagues made recently, which is David Brooks, the opinion columnist for The Times, and I did an event in Washington, and he told the audience that, you know, he jokes that there's going to be a new unit of confidence that's invented, like to measure how much confidence a person has, and it's going to be called the Obama. And, you know, everybody will be evaluated and told, oh, you have one Obama, you have two Obamas, you have three Obamas. And the thing that we really see in the presidency is that a president's greatest asset can also be his greatest detriment. So on the one hand, Obama's confidence has been a huge asset for him, because think of what he was able to do in 2008, right? I mean, he took on the Democratic frontrunner, Hillary Clinton. He ran an insurgent campaign that was really successful, and he smashed this racial barrier that lots of people thought would never be smashed. And so all of that took extraordinary self-confidence. And yet in the presidency, at times it was much more of a liability, because the guy really was new, and he really did have a lot to learn when he got to Washington.
Of course, the other part of it is the expectation level. Having won the nomination against Hillary, having been elected as the first black president, that the expectations of what he might be able to accomplish were so dramatically high.
Well, but you could argue that that's part of the confidence issue, too, because he made such incredible promises during the 2008 campaign. I mean, to some extent, people may have had their own fantasies about what he could accomplish, but he certainly buoyed them and bolstered them. I mean, if you go back to some of those campaign rallies, I mean, man, the language that he was using was almost biblical, you know, in terms of the vast transformative promises he was making. And some of those did come back to haunt him.
One of the things you write about is that Michelle, over time, has really enhanced a sense that obviously she had, to some extent at the beginning, a sense of image, a sense of presentation. Talk a little about that.
She definitely does. You know, she often is the person more aware of images than her husband. I mean, if we look at some of the iconic photographs of her from this presidency, you know, we see her hula hooping with kids, or we see her hopscotching barefoot with kids in India, you know, on a state visit, and we see that she is somebody who really knows the power of a picture. And her husband can be a little bit less interested in that. You know, he specifically rejected the kind of, you know, sort of mission accomplished like images that some past presidents have used to glorify their accomplishments. But I think you see her savvy in that every day now. I don't know if you saw the clip of her on Ellen DeGeneres' show doing push-ups, but I think she's very astute about what will make a good video clip that people will want to share online.
And has she been able to inculcate that sense in her husband?
You know, it's funny, because I can't say for sure, but I think you're on to something, because just as we were talking, I saw that the White House sent out an email about the president launching a marshmallow projectile yesterday at the White House. And this was part of a science fair that they did there. They had kids to a science fair, and this kid, for some sort of physics project, created a marshmallow shooter. And the president picks it up, and lo and behold, is shooting marshmallows across the White House. And that is the kind of, you know, charming, funny, casual image of the president we really haven't seen since the 2008 campaign. And I just want to acknowledge that we are in an absurd world where the president shooting a marshmallow in the East Wing can potentially get more attention than, you know, some foreign policy development that he's announced today, right? So we have to be honest with ourselves and admit that we're suckers for these kinds of images.
I guess. Talk a little bit about this decision he made when they first got to the White House about wanting to have dinner with the family at 6:30 as many nights as possible.
Well, it's interesting because I want to tell you a little bit about reader reaction. One of the things I report in the book, which hadn't been known before, is that the president has a two-night-a-week rule, meaning he refuses to miss dinner with his family more than two nights a week, barring extenuating circumstances, of course. And so, you know, his motivation was that he really wanted to maintain some sort of normal family life. Keep in mind that the Obamas had never lived full time together before they moved into the White House, because he was always a legislator commuting to capitals. And so, so I report this information, and I've gotten two very different reactions from readers. I've gotten the positive reaction, which is, gee, I'm really glad that his commitment to his family is so authentic and that it's not just for show. And by the way, he should be doing whatever it is he needs to do to stay sane during this presidency if having dinner with his family is what keeps him grounded and happy. You know, I have no problem with that. I've also gotten the negative reaction of people saying, wait a second, I have a regular job, and I have to miss dinner with my family a couple of nights a week, and given the state of the economy and given the state of joblessness, I want this guy working all the time.
Right. And let me use that as a jumping off point, because there's the impression, or at least the impression I had, that in some respects it was an excuse. It was a way for him to commit to doing something that on the surface seems very attractive, but yet takes away from him having to do more of the schmoozing, more of the Washington political activity that arguably might have been beneficial, but that he's less comfortable doing.
I think that you are right about that. One theme I found in my reporting is that the Obamas were constantly seeking ways to escape, to protect themselves, to limit their time in the public sphere, and we see it with both Obamas. The First Lady said she only wanted to work 2 days a week when she got to the White House, and the President, that he didn't want to miss dinner with his family more than two nights a week. So I think that was absolutely a theme early on. I think it may be changing a little bit now because the first few months of the administration were so overwhelming, and, you know, the shock of arrival was so great, and the First Lady was having a hard time, and the country's problems were so enormous. And now that they're more used to the White House, it does make sense to me that they're loosening up a little bit.
And the other thing that was so surprising in so many ways that comes out in your reporting is this idea that they didn't want to have any new friends once they got to the White House.
I know. Isn't that interesting? There's a real, and I think that's changed a tiny bit now, but the reason it's surprising is that most people in politics really rise by making friends. I tell a story that I love about Barbara and George Bush moving around the South in the 70s. And Barbara kept index cards for every person they met. You know, she so carefully assembled their contacts. And, you know, within a few years, she had thousands and thousands of index cards with all of these different people listed on them. And she sent, she sent out Christmas cards to all these people every year. And the Obamas were never like that. And I think it's because when the president became sort of famous overnight in 2004 with that speech that we all remember from the Boston Convention, it was like everybody wanted a piece of him. He didn't have to do the thing with the 5,000 index cards. There was an overwhelming demand for him, for his time, et cetera, et cetera. And so the Obamas' focus, their lives changed so quickly, and they became much more protective, much more limiting. They have a really small tribe of close friends that they spend most of their time with. And, you know, also a lot of Chicagoans I've talked to found it very hard to maintain friendships with the president and first lady because there's kind of this question of the etiquette, right? I mean, Jeff, if somebody you know becomes the president or the first lady, you know, you would be sitting there in California saying, is it okay to send an email? Who would I email?
Right.
You know, I don't want to bother them. On the other hand, maybe they do want news from home. You know, what if I send a note to the White House and I don't hear back? Does that mean I'm out of favor?
You tell the story about Michelle Obama's awareness of being a role model, particularly to young black women, and you tell it in the context of the story about her decision whether or not to be on the cover of Vogue. To what extent is he aware of his role as a role model?
Oh, very aware, I think. Absolutely. You know, you hear him talk about fatherhood a lot. You hear him talking about spending time with kids, about turning off the TV and doing homework with your kids. I think he's absolutely aware of it. You know, it's funny because the Obamas don't kind of talk that much about their, especially being African-American role models, but they're so acutely aware of it. I mean, we all know what's going on with black men and fatherhood in this country, and I think he's, all of them are so aware that this is a rare chance to reverse a negative stereotype.
What did they learn, if anything, from looking at the Clinton presidency?
Well, it's a great question because, you know, the Obamas have a very complicated relationship with the Clintons, and this goes back to even before the 2008 campaign. I mean, the Obamas really kind of objected to the Clinton way of doing things, and you know, it goes to a kind of theme with the president, which is that the president came into politics with a lot of kind of principled objections to the way things are done, but some of those objections didn't turn out to be very practical. So part of what we're seeing now is that he is doing things more the Clinton way, you know, very incremental. He's in a tough situation with the House controlled by Republicans with no real money to work with in the budget. And so he's been forced to adapt some, you know, sort of Clinton-like tactics. And he studied the Clinton playbook very hard during the budget battles as well. What I think we're still waiting to see is how much kind of personal reconciliation there is between those two guys, because we know that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama clearly have, you know, a decent working relationship. People describe them as sort of two professionals on their best behavior with each other. But Bill Clinton and Barack Obama have never gotten along particularly well.
And as you and others have pointed out in regard to all of this, in some ways, Michelle is more like Bill and he's...
Yes. Yes. Well, when you look at these video clips of Michelle Obama making the rounds, she is really the person who can light up a room, who has incredible warmth, who can make people feel very welcome and very important. And the president is a little bit more like Hillary Clinton in terms of being this sort of natural, super serious policy person who has to work hard at being a charismatic politician.
And coming back to where we started, how do you see their relationship, their partnership, their marriage continuing to evolve?
Well, it's a great question, and I think, first of all, it depends on whether or not he wins in 2012, because, you know, that's a fork in the road. If he wins, their lives and their future and their legacy and their post-presidency will be one thing, and if he loses, it will be completely another. But, you know, whether it's 2012 or 2016, that's the end of the story, they're both going to be pretty young when they get out. And so, you know, the smart money is on them going back to Chicago. And I think the question is what they will do then. I mean, their daughters are very young. Even if he gets another term, Sasha will still be in high school. So parenting is obviously going to be a priority for a long time. But it is interesting to think about whether he wants to have the very traditional kind of post-presidency with the library and the rest of it, or whether we might see the Obamas take things in a more creative direction.
And do you think that she will continue to emerge and have more policy influence and act as more of a muse, if you will? I'm reluctant to use the word, but why not?
You know, I do think that will be true to a limited extent. I mean, this is not a first lady who's interested in, like, the details of nuclear disarmament, right? I mean,
right.
She's never going to be involved on a granular level. But I think that mission we talked about, that sense of her really holding the president to the reasons he won in the first place, her being very conscious of the way Americans view him, her wanting to really focus on fundamental social change. I mean, what's interesting about the president's key messages right now and key initiatives is that, in a way, they are very much in keeping with the things that the Obamas have cared about for a long time. You know, if the goal of a second term, as the president put it in his State of the Union address, is to make America a more economically just place, you know, as somebody who's done a lot of biographical work on the Obamas, that really rings true with what they've wanted for a very long time. I think the question is how much he can really accomplish, given all the limitations.
Jody Kantor, the book is The Obamas. It's just out from Little Brown. Jody, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure, Jeff.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.